Hello, everyone. This is Robert Stark. Our returning guest for today's show is Charles Lincoln. Hey, Charles. Nice having you back on.
Thank you very much, Robert.
So where we left off on our last interview is we were discussing your letter to the bishop about slavery and what we were going to touch on, which we're devoting this show to, is the issue of how slavery tied into the prison industrial complex, which we have today. Is that correct?
Well, I think that the point I was making at the end of the last session was that if you read the 13th Amendment closely, what it says precisely is that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist except as a punishment for crime. And what very few people think about, what they don't teach in the schools, of course, and what very few people on the street would even think about, is the fact that that is a gigantic loophole that transformed America. And the way it transformed America is that it made punishment for a crime an integral part of American society to a degree unparalleled anywhere else in the world. I mean, a lot of people, or at least some people are aware, some people, I guess, on our side of the political spectrum are aware that the United States is, in fact, the most imprisoning nation in the world, that we hold more prisoners per capita as a percentage of our population than Communist China, Nazi Germany.
In both per capita and in the sheer numbers.
Exactly, yes. You know, if you want to go to jail, the land of the free is the place to go. So, in a sense, America has betrayed its birthright in every possible way, and it is the established government that continues to sort of usurp power over the people, pretending to be a constitutional government that is doing that. And, I mean, obviously, the way to understand slavery is to first define what it means to be free, and then what elements of freedom were taken away by chattel slavery as it existed in the ancient world in the Old South, and what elements of freedom are being taken away today. And basically, if you do an inventory of the elements of freedom and how many people have lost those elements of freedom, and if you look at it on a society-wide basis, basically, the United States was a freer place when we had slavery than it is now. And this is part of why I am so inalterably opposed to my own church's attempt at so-called racial reconciliation and to apologize for slavery, because as much as I would not want to be a slave on a plantation in the Old South, and I'm sure that basically nobody in the United States or anywhere in the world probably would ever admit to wanting chattel slavery to come back. And even in the immediate aftermath of the war between the states, there were very few people in the South who were formally advocating a return to chattel slavery. But the simple reality is that the country was much freer in 1860 as a whole than it is now. Go through the inventory of what it means to be free and then what it means to be a slave and find out how many elements affect everybody, whereas in 1860 it only affected a fraction of the population. And obviously I think that the existence of, you use this phrase, this rather complicated phrase, the prison industrial complex, that suggests a strong relationship between what Marxists might call the means of production and the means of social control. And I think that that is a good entry point into understanding the changes that took place between 1860 and 1960, and in fact have accelerated since 1960 until the present.
Yeah, there were basically two times in history. Well, the whole thing with the prison industry, it really got started right after slavery was abolished. And then later on in the 20th century, after the civil rights movement, you saw this explosion in mass incarceration that really it really got started, I'd say, like in the 1970s, and it accelerated even more in the 80s and 90s.
Well, there have been two booms in prison population and prison construction in U.S. history. One was in the 1920s during Prohibition, and the other was in starting in the late 1960s, 1970s, up through the present, the so-called war on drugs. And, you know, the difference between Prohibition and the war on drugs is, again, I think somewhat illustrative of the change that has taken place in the United States and the change that has taken place in our popular understanding of the Constitution. What is the biggest constitutional difference between Prohibition and the war on drugs? The big difference from a constitutional standpoint is that there was a constitutional amendment allowing prohibition of alcohol, and there has never been a constitutional amendment allowing the war on drugs.
So the first one, even though you think prohibition's a bad thing, are you saying it technically was constitutional?
Prohibition was adopted according to the Constitution as a constitutional amendment. As a practical matter, it turned out to be one of the worst ideas in history, except for the war on drugs. But in essence, it shows that as of 1919, 1920, people in the United States, not even 100 years ago, still believed in the Constitution enough to say that the United States government should not have any power that was not specifically granted to it by the Constitution. So those people who wanted to prohibit the sale of alcohol had no choice but to follow in the footsteps of the people who wanted to abolish the first form of private property ever abolished. What was that?
Are you talking about slavery?
Exactly. In other words, both in 1865, even at the end of Lincoln's war on the South, Abraham Lincoln's, not mine. The war
no, between, and there's no confirmed relation.
Between what?
You and Lincoln.
Well, no, I mean, there is a confirmed relation, but it goes back to the 1630s, so it ain't much of a relation. I'm probably as closely related to you as I am to Abe. Seriously. We all must be a lot more closely related than we think we are, because there aren't enough ancestors to go around. In England, I think, I don't know if it was on the last show we were on or some other conversation I was having with somebody, commented that absolutely everyone in England is related to Charles II, because Charles II had something on the order of 242 bastard children while he was king, and those were scattered all over the English realm, and so it's hard to find anyone in England who is not within the past 300 years related to Charles II.
So the same, like everyone in Central Asia is a descendant of Genghis Khan.
I don't know how many children he had, if he had on the order of thousands, which I guess he could have. Perhaps that's true.
So back to the topic of slavery, you were saying that is the first abolition of private property.
In 1865, you have the 13th Amendment. Not all of your listeners may be aware there's a certain controversy about whether it should be called the 13th Amendment or not, because in the immediate aftermath of, or actually right before the War of 1812, there was another 13th Amendment that was adopted, which concerned titles of nobility. It never became part of the official canon of the Constitution, but some people say it was properly adopted and should be considered part of the real Constitution, but no court today would ever enforce that, and so everybody counts 12th Amendment as the amendment after the Adams-Jefferson election of 1800, where they reformed the way that presidents are elected, and then the 13th Amendment is the one adopted in 1865, but I just wanted to tip my hat to those who say that there was an earlier 13th Amendment, which for various reasons was suppressed. But the 13th Amendment and then Prohibition uniquely recognized that the original Constitution grants no power over the regulation of intrastate commerce. And again, this is why the war on drugs is arguably so completely illegal and unconstitutional, along with a lot of the other aspects of the welfare.
Well, I would clarify that the federal war on drugs, I guess technically the states have a constitutional right to make their own drug laws.
Well, I think that it may be too broad a topic to go into too much here, but I think the argument can be made that even the state wars on drugs would be prohibited if you were to apply the Bill of Rights uniformly to all the states. You wanted to discuss the prison industrial complex, and in order to discuss the prison industrial complex, we have to discuss what preceded the prison industrial complex and what the reality is of economics then and economics today. And I find it very interesting that freedom inevitably included for the non-slave northern states and for England and for France after the abolition of slavery in those countries, freedom inevitably included the freedom to starve and to end up on the streets like Fantine or so in Victor Hugo's Miserables or so many of the characters in Charles Dickens' novels. In the South, the relationship of production and labor were different in the existence of chattel slavery. If you starve your slave, you lose your slave. You kill him. If you deny your slave shelter, you are likely to kill him the same way, maybe a little bit slower.
Yeah, basically a slave owner, they could murder their slave, and it would not be a crime. But you're saying there was an economic incentive because that argument was put forth during the Civil War era, because in the North you had the factory. It was much common for factory workers in the North. Most of them were, a lot of them were immigrants from, a lot of them from Ireland, who a lot of them starved to death.
Freezing to death in winter, starving to death in the summer, dying of lack of health care. These were common aspects of free labor, not just in the North, but in England, Ireland, France, Germany, all over industrialized Europe.
And on the record, Charles Lincoln is not saying he endorses slavery.
I'm not saying I endorse slavery at all, because actually what I'm saying is we need, in order to understand the problems with slavery, we need to understand what exactly it means to be free. And what I'm really saying, above all, and what the reason we started this with my letter to the Bishop of Louisiana, and by the way, they already had that reprehensible ecumenical mass for racial reconciliation, and Bishop Catherine Shorey came down from Washington and presided at the cathedral where my parents got married, and she asked all the white people to beg on their knees for forgiveness for the sin of slavery. And what I'm telling you is that even if slavery, chattel slavery, is a non-ideal condition in which to live, it is nothing that we need to apologize for. That's what I'm saying. And this is what I want to emphasize, because what I'm really saying is that even in the United States in general, what I protest most about the apology for slavery is that what the systems that have replaced slavery in the United States, which are perhaps colorblind and they apply to everyone equally without regard to race, creed, or color, deprive more people of more freedom than slavery did in its day, and that if you add, again, the utter freedom of people who are not slaves, you add together the elements of freedom that people who were not slaves had in 1860, and you compare it, even weighing down the freedom that was lost by those who were slaves, America in 1860 was a freer country than America in 2014. It was even a freer country than America in 1960, and basically the road to serfdom started with the abolition of chattel slavery, which was, you know, for better or for worse, it was a population limited segment of society that was enslaved. And when freedom is redefined to mean less freedom, then there's something wrong. And I think that this too is another problem that deeply bothers me, is equality of freedom almost inevitably means non-freedom. And so equality and liberty are at odds with each other. And, you know, the French motto, liberté, égalité, fraternité, notwithstanding. And I think that in terms of modern Americans' understanding of how we got to where we are right now, we live in a society where everyone is afraid of something. Everyone is afraid of the equivalent of the slave master's whip. Either they're afraid of the IRS, or they're afraid of, you know, being arrested for their recreational drugs, or they're afraid of losing their business because of failure to comply with environmental regulations, or they are afraid to run afoul of the government in ways which were simply unimaginable in 1860.
And it's important to point out that in sheer numbers, there are far more people in prison than there were ever slaves.
Just thinking in terms of race, there are more black people either in jail or on probation than there ever were slaves at all. More black people in some sort of restraint on their liberty. And that in itself is a fascinating issue, because obviously one of the perverse and peculiar things that happened all over the United States, not just in the South, but all over the United States, is that once the blacks were free, they had to be redefined by society as criminals. And thousands of new crimes were invented. I mean, I don't think you will ever find any indication that either in colonial America or England of the 18th or early 19th century, that people were routinely arrested for loitering, for instance. I mean,
yeah,
I don't know if you know
ever go, if you ever go by like a strip mall or a 7-Eleven, there's always a big sign that says "No loitering. Violators will be prosecuted and arrested."
Exactly. And you know, if I don't know if you're familiar with the biography of Benjamin Franklin, but basically Benjamin Franklin, you know, ran away from home in Boston when he was a young man, and basically, he was a vagrant and a loiterer for a while. And, you know, that was 100 years before Mark Twain and wrote the stories of Tom Thumb and Huck Finn. But basically, the idea that people could run away and be loiterers and vagrants in America was part of American freedom for a very long time. And now, you know, in story after story, we hear of children being arrested who run away from home, who try to emancipate themselves informally by, you know, escaping, just absenting themselves from routines or home regimes that they find oppressive. And that whole aspect of American freedom, the freedom to move away from what you do not like, the freedom to do what William, do you know who William Barrett Travis was? William Barrett Travis was the commander of the Alamo. And he's most famous for this.
Oh, was he the county, Travis County, Austin? It was named after him.
Yes, exactly. It was William Barrett Travis. And in any event, there he was at the Alamo, surrounded by 6,000 Mexican troops. There are like 183 Anglos, 200 Anglos, and sympathetic Mexicans of Texas birth hold up in the Alamo with him. 30-1 odds. He knew he didn't have much of a chance, and he wrote this famous letter, "I am besieged," or "We are besieged," and concluding, "I will never surrender or retreat." Now, he's become one of Texas's and really the whole country's ideals of human freedom and liberty. But let me tell you about William Barrett Travis. William Barrett Travis today not only would never have made it to the Alamo, he probably never would have made it out of jail at all, because he was a deadbeat dad in three sequential families. I think it's three. Might just be two, but they were big families. He had a lot of kids, and basically he in South Carolina, he basically ran away from his obligations. William Barrett Travis, much like Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, represented a certain kind of lawless freedom, which for many years was the essence of America.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the American folk heroes, most of them, a lot of them were outlaws.
That's very important to point out.
And with the whole concept of the prison industrial complex, its base, one of the bases is obviously there's a lot of jobs that it produces, and it's a whole economic industry, but it was able to utilize basically slave labor, and that, well, it's one of the things that happened in the South after the abolition of slavery.
Not just in the South, and
in the whole country, but especially if you look at statistics, the Southern states to this day have the highest incarceration rates, but it was a way to utilize that labor.
It was indeed, but I mean, what do you know about the construction of Hoover Dam and the other dams along the Colorado River?
So they did use prison labor for that.
Yes. Every dam, every major waterworks project in the West, as a matter of fact. So, I mean, we're not just talking about the South here. And that's a point that I think is kind of significant, because the prison industrial complex began growing in the States almost immediately after the enactment of the 13th Amendment. Yes, it started off, as is illustrated in the movie Gone with the Wind, with things like sawmills and construction teams, road building, small industries. It got bigger, and intriguingly, it got more and more widespread everywhere. And, of course, very few people realize, and I have to admit, I had never quite realized until recently just how unique the American federal prisons system is. There was no federal prison system at all prior to the war between the states. There were very few federal crimes. There are only four crimes enumerated in the Constitution. And prior to the war between the states, federal prosecution was almost unheard of. Piracy, counterfeiting of coin, treason, those are three of the four crimes enumerated in the Constitution. I think there's a fourth one. I can't remember what it is right now. But piracy, obviously, was punished because the United States had the monopoly over creating a navy. Counterfeiting was a federal...
Today, piracy means something totally different, but it would get you sent to federal prison. Because you always see those warnings, those FBI warnings. And now it's not just the FBI, it's Department of Homeland Security. If you watch a movie that says, if you pirate this movie, you'll get 5 years in federal prison.
Okay, that is not actually piracy. Piracy always meant piracy on the high seas. Now, you raise an interesting point, though, because intellectual property piracy, arguably, now, the Constitution does authorize Congress to issue patents and copyrights. That is permissible under the Constitution. And so to steal copyrighted material, to steal patented material, I'm not aware of any pre 1860 prosecutions for either one of those things. It's part of the federal criminal complex that grows up in the late...
So it was a civil issue. It was a civil issue originally.
I'm just saying that potentially, because of that authorization in the Constitution, that I can imagine it being argued that the prosecution of theft of intellectual property, like trademarks and copyright and patented information across state lines, I can imagine that that would be considered constitutional. I mean, it's interesting that you bring that up, because using that phrase, piracy, it's kind of wild. I actually attended, as an observer, I attended a real piracy trial back here in Los Angeles in the 1980s. A man was accused of murdering his wife on their honeymoon. on the high seas at a cruise.
Was this basically. as when you were a judicial clerk?
Exactly. Have I told you the story before?
No, you haven't told me the specific story.
Okay, well, yes, when I was working for Stephen Reinhardt on the Ninth Circuit. And anyhow, so piracy does still exist, and I mean, that's basically with the absence of other jurisdictions. I mean, who else would prosecute a murder on the high seas other than the federal government? But what I wanted to point out was that there was no such thing as a federal prison prior to 1860. And as a matter of fact, all that existed at the federal level under the original Constitution or the original cabinet was the Office of the Attorney General. There was an Attorney General of the United States from the earliest days of the Washington administration forward. But in 1870, under Ulysses Grant, they created something oxymoronically enough called the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice was what then began formulating and prosecuting federal crimes. So starting in 1870, you have the prosecution of federal crimes. And in 1875, they authorized the first purchase of property specifically for a federal prison, and that was at Leavenworth, Kansas. But they don't actually start building a new federal prison facility at Leavenworth until the 1890s. The second federal prison is at Atlanta, Georgia, 1902. It got somewhat famous during the Leo Franks case. And then the third is an island off the state of Washington. And up until 1925, you only had those three federal prison facilities. And starting right in the middle of Prohibition in 1925, you have the first explosion in construction of federal so-called correctional facilities. Every state from 1865 onwards was in the business of constructing both prison camps and fortress-like prisons. You know, fortress-like prison basically did not exist anywhere in the United States prior to 1860. They used pre-existing fortresses to imprison people, specifically U.S. forts, United States military installations that were called forts. Those were used as prisons, but they were not built exclusively for that purpose. But starting in the 1870s, you get a boom in state-level construction of prisons that had not existed before. And basically, starting in the 1890s, you then get the construction of federal prisons, a boom in the 1920s, and yes, in the 1930s, and ever since then, it has been part of the welfare state that you need to employ people by creating work for them and giving low-skilled employees a job in prisons has and continues to be, if you watch late-night TV, I do as rarely as possible, but sometimes I got nothing else to do and I turn it on. And even today, you still see these horrible ads asking people who are doing nothing else in the middle of the night to join in the fastest-growing industry in the United States, which is the correctional services industry. The correctional services industry. And of course, that is just about the most depressing thing I think we can think about, that in this land of the free and home of the brave, that the best option for uneducated, unskilled individuals is to become prison guards. That's really what it means.
And you've actually, you've had firsthand experience with these people, so I think what we should touch on is where does the Charles Lincoln prison experience begin?
I'd say that the Charles Lincoln's first experience with a prison-like environment was when I first attended first grade, actually.
Yeah.
I think that most people perhaps balk at the notion, but the explosion in prisons in the United States actually did coincide with the explosion in public school education. And I don't think that that's an accident. I don't think that these phenomena are unrelated. I think that both have to do with the increasing demand for uniformity in behavior, the suppression of the William Barrett Travises, the Huckleberry Finns, and the Tom Sawyers,
and the Benjamin Charles Lincoln. And the Charles Lincolns.
Well, Charles Lincoln is still here. He has not been suppressed yet. But on the other hand,
they tried to suppress you, and they did. They did throw you in prison. They did that.
Well, you know, it was one of the great experiences of my life, I have to say, and I don't say that I want to live there or anything, but basically, between being arrested twice in 2006 and 2007, I managed to spend a total of approximately 2 months in federal custody, and I cannot think of any comparable two-month period anywhere in my life, whether it be at Harvard or University of Chicago or anywhere else, where I learned as much about the world as I learned in those 60 days. And I guess probably want to spend some more time on that because, oddly enough, I occasionally think about doing wild and crazy things like run for public office. And in doing so, I realize I'm exposing myself to a lot of people saying, well, I mean, you were arrested. What right do you have running for public office anywhere? To which I suppose it would be a highly politically incorrect response to say that the most widely read book in political philosophy published during the 1900s was written in prison. But that issue aside, anyone who wants to understand the truth about freedom in America needs to look at the heart of darkness that this nation has created for itself in the federal prison. It is the ugliest, most disgusting, most degrading place you can imagine. We have created, in the American prison system, we have created hell on earth.
So you're saying it's worse in the condition that the slaves were in?
In essence, there is no comparison. If you had a choice between being locked in a basically a 10 by 10 cement box with a steel toilet and a sink, or living in a thatched hut with a dirt floor where you could see the sun, feel the rain, can you tell me what you'd choose?
What I find hilarious is, I'll give you one example of the hypocrisy, is it's among mainline conservatives, how mainline conservatives are so horrified if they find out someone is a racist or a segregationist, but they are big supporters of mass incarceration, and you could make an argument that is a racist thing. In a sense, if you want to point out the hypocrisy of those people.
I'd say that the hypocrisy goes way deeper than racism. I would say that it is that racism itself is still avoiding the issue. The issue is freedom versus the complete absence of freedom. And nowhere outside of the American prison system has the absence of freedom ever been so totally perfected. I mean, the cement block fortresses that we call prisons, correctional facilities, detention centers in the United States right now are inescapable except by death. And that fact in itself is radically different from any condition under which slaves were ever held anywhere. But what you've got to realize about modern prisons is that in the federal systems and in the state systems both, prisoners are being put to work at pennies on the hour. We're not talking about minimum wage. We are talking they are being put to work at pennies on the hour, and they are being dressed up in a uniform which is entirely based on the communist Chinese uniform of basically like loose pajamas, and they want to make it as impossible to use even your clothes as a weapon as they can possibly conceive of. So they basically dress everybody up in orange pajamas.
Did you say, actually, in one of your cases, you actually wore the old school black and white stripes?
In Florida, when I was arrested on the order of a judge in Texas who wanted to talk to me, that was why I was arrested. He wanted judge.
You were not actually charged with a crime. It's because the judge wanted to talk to you.
Never charged with a crime. That's correct. I was summoned by judges who wanted to talk to me that I didn't want to not choose to talk to. But I actually told Lynn Hughes when he finally told me that I actually would have talked to him because there's a Starbucks right across from the Houston Federal Courthouse, and I would have met him there any time. He didn't think it was all that funny, but it was also true. The point is that they tried to do terrible things to you. They tried to inject me with some ghastly-looking syringe that looked worse than anything I'd ever seen in a science fiction movie at that point in my life. It was a really large syringe, and I just said no. And they said they could force me, and I said, well, you're going to have to force me. And they didn't actually want to physically force me, so they dressed me up in... They made me put on a form of the prison uniform, which was bright red, meaning toxic alert, because I wouldn't accept a shot. I think it was supposed to be a TB shot or something like that. It just didn't look anything like a TB shot to me, so I wasn't willing to do it. But that was the most degrading thing I ever...
Was this in a county jail or a federal prison?
It was in a state holding facility that was being used by the Middle District of Florida as a holding tank. I mean, since I wasn't actually charged with anything, they didn't exactly know what to do with me. The most convenient place to put me was in a state facility close to the federal courthouse in Jacksonville, and I spent a week there, and then they let me go, and it was a very strange experience. But no, I never wore black and white. I did wear this bright reddish pink thing to say that I was toxic because I wouldn't take this injection. And then in MDC Los Angeles, where I was arrested in December of 2007, they just had me wearing ordinary orange. But, you know, nothing is comparable to this prison costume more than what you see the Chinese workers wearing during the Cultural Revolution. And the whole federal prison system is very, very clearly designed on a communist Chinese model. And all of these variations in the organization and structure of the American prison system post-date the Nixon-Kissinger détente with China. And I can't help but feel that basically Messrs. Nixon and Kissinger very consciously tried to introduce Chinese communist ideology into the American prison culture and situation. And I think we desperately need to appreciate just how evil the infiltration of these ideas is. And it wasn't the Chinese who brought them in. It was our own government, really great traitors like Richard Milhouse Nixon and Henry M. Kissinger.
If you ever watch Law and Order, they always threaten people with the fear of a homosexual rape. What role does that play in our popular culture, and how accurate is that in reality?
Well, again, it's not a reality that I have any experience with at all. If it exists anywhere, I really don't think it exists in the federal system, because basically one of the ways that they make prison so ghastly is they are watching you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on camera, and every complaint that any inmate files against any other inmate becomes a source of great problems for everybody involved. And there is no privacy. There's no possibility of anything like a prison rape culture in any of the facilities I saw, because everybody who's in there has heard of this legend, and they're so scared of it that they go out of their way to be like hyper heterosexual, bragging about their girlfriends and how much they miss their girlfriends. And really, it's one of the most boring things about prison life is that, you know, they'd basically rather talk about their girlfriends than the massive injustice of anyone being locked in these facilities. but I think it's because of the psychological trauma of the fear.
So you're saying it's used as a psychological weapon to cause
torture,
people, yeah, psychological, you say it's a form of psychological torture.
Yes, it really is, and it's a way of distracting people from the injustice of their of the fact that they're in there at all, because they're trying to...
Or psychological, you could say psychological torture against the masses, because people, it is ingrained in popular culture, so people are like, hey man, I don't want to challenge the government, because this might happen.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
And Hollywood is totally complacent in it.
Complicit, you mean? Yes.
Complicit,
yeah. I guess they're complacent in some regards and complicit in others. Both words would be appropriate. So anyhow, I think that we definitely have a nightmare in the land of the free, which is that the land of the free has become the land of people terrorized by their own government with the threat of cruel and unusual prison conditions, which basically defy the imagination, because the dehumanization of life in prison is really something that very few people, I think, can conceive. Prison rape is not a problem, but I'll tell you what is a terrible problem is excessive air conditioning. They basically try to freeze you to death.
That probably basically shuts off anyone's sex drive.
It's an amazing experience. It shuts off your desire to get up. It shuts off your desire to think. It shuts off your ability, really, if you're asthmatic like me, it shuts off your ability to breathe.
I know Sheriff Joe Arpaio, he does the opposite. He has his inmates out in the hot desert without any air conditioning, and people say that's inhumane of him doing that. So I guess it could be both ways.
What I would say is that mass imprisonment is inherently inhumane. Mass imprisonment is inherently inhumane. It really doesn't matter how you do it. I mean, I'm sure that those prison camps in Arizona are inhumane. I really have no doubt they are really and truly inhumane. But I can tell you from my own experience that the refrigerators that they put federal prisons into are quite inhumane and morally and mentally destructive. And they are destructive of the human soul. But above everything, they're destructive of the American dream and also the American promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We have to take control of this country again by restoring the right of everyone to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And basically that means cutting back on the number of things that we call criminal. Ayn Rand, you may be familiar with, she wrote back in 1946 that the purpose of the state was to create enough crimes that everyone could be considered a criminal when it was convenient to consider everyone, any particular person, a criminal. And that is the reality that I think we've got right now. The regulatory system, the criminal justice system, the inventory of crimes is such that every person alive today has done something, whether they know it or not, that can be called either a federal or state crime or both. And that is what we really have to take charge of and change in this country. We need to reverse the heritage of Abraham Lincoln. We need to reverse the heritage of the emancipation of the slaves and the enslavement of free people that happened after 1865. We need a new birth of freedom in this country, and it has to be accompanied by a complete teardown of the so-called justice and criminal justice systems. And in the process, it is good if we can reassess the relationship between productive labor and social control by truly understanding the elements of freedom and the elements of slavery and understanding what it takes to build a truly free society, which is a society in which you can bargain away your freedom, but no one can take it.
Well, you know what? I think we've covered a lot of excellent topics. So, Charles Lincoln, I'd like to thank you for being on. But, you know, one more thing is last show I forgot to plug your website. So your main website is charleslincoln3.com. And you have another website. You have the one Southern Spirit Rising.
Your main SouthernSpiritRising.com, to say I have not worked much on charleslincoln3.com. That's also known as Tierra Limpia. You'll recognize that one immediately when you go to it.
Yeah, that's the one. They can read your biography, and you have your whole prison experience story up on that part where your biography is.
Yes, and I've also got another website, which is homeownersjustice.com, homeownersjustice at homestead.com, .homestead.com.
So is that the Vindicatio one?
I have reserved the name Vindicatio.com, but I haven't actually developed any of the Vindicatio sites as yet. That's a project I hope I'll be able to get to this spring, and perhaps in conjunction with some of the work that I may be doing on some of these campaigns, and I guess we should probably reserve that for another
show. You are thinking about running for Congress, but we will save that for our next show. And
because
so
it will be much better defined by the time we comes around.
All right, so Charles, I'm wrapping up this show. Thanks again for being on.
Well, happy Groundhog Day, or happy Candlemas, whatever you want to celebrate this weekend.
Oh, if the show's posted on Groundhog Day, but who knows when it'll be posted. But thanks again.
You take care. Bye-bye.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.